This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News podcast, we're covering the latest in the Middle East, where Israel and Hamas have signed their ceasefire and hostage release agreement, which is due to take effect on Sunday. But until then, the war continues, with Palestinian authorities reporting at least 86 deaths from continued Israeli airstrikes on the territory since the announcement of the truce. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin today in Israel in a cabinet meeting that's taking place right now to decide whether to ratify the Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal announced on Wednesday. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has enough support in cabinet for the agreement, but it may yet cost him the support of a couple of far-right members of his coalition, the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, and perhaps the Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich too. And last night, their supporters blocked a highway in Jerusalem to show their opposition to the deal. Many others in Israel, however, are welcoming the agreement, especially the families of the hostages still being held by Hamas in Gaza. Mr. Netanyahu says that if ratified, he expects the first hostages to be released on Sunday. Gil Dickman is the cousin of Carmel Gat, who was killed while in captivity in Gaza.
I believe all deals are bad in a way, because we're going to give things that we don't want to give. But all deals are good in a way that we're going to get hostages back. And right now, the deal that we're having is the same deal that we had on the table in May. The only thing that's changed is that some of the hostages were killed in captivity, just like my cousin. She was alive in May. She should have been a part of this deal. She should have been one of the first to come home in this deal, but they didn't sign it in time. She was murdered, and now we have the same deal, only less hostages.
Well, let's speak to Neri Zilber, journalist with the Financial Times, based in Tel Aviv, who joins us live. Welcome to NewsHour, Neri. What's the latest on the cabinet meeting? What are you hearing?
Well, good to be back with you, James. That's right. The Israeli government, the full cabinet, is meeting as we speak. And it's expected to approve the Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal. And this comes about an hour or two ago. The smaller security cabinet in the Netanyahu government approved the deal. So we expect it to pass and for implementation to actually begin on Sunday, hopefully.
Will there be any resignations over this, do you think?
Well, as of last night, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the far-right national security minister, already promised that once this deal was approved by the government and implementation began, that he would actually resign and pull his Jewish Power Party out of the Netanyahu coalition. So I expect him to make good on that threat and promise tonight or likely in the coming days. And so that will shake the Netanyahu coalition, but it won't really alter the politics and the math of Netanyahu's parliamentary majority. He'll still have a majority in parliament, but it will be an interesting dynamic, maybe with follow-on implications for, as mentioned, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who so far is obviously adamantly opposed to this deal, but will likely let it pass and may pull out of the government in 6 weeks at the end of the first stage of the ceasefire, but that remains to be seen.
Those differing responses, I mean, from the outside, it always seemed that Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, although from different parties, usually were pretty unified in their responses to government policy. I mean, what's changed for Bezalel Smotrich, do you think? What is his thinking about why he should stay?
Well, let's be clear. Both men, both politicians are opposed to this deal. Smotrich himself this week called it a catastrophe for Israeli national security. But they have slightly differing political bases and slightly differing political positions at the moment. Bezalel Smotrich and his party are not doing quite well in the polls. So they have a lot more to lose, say, if elections were called, if the Netanyahu government collapsed, relative to Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is riding a bit higher and may not be as afraid of snap elections as Smotrich. Also, Bezalel Smotrich is seen as more ideological in the sense that they're obviously both pro settlements in the occupied West Bank. But Smotrich is seen as maybe hewing more closely to that demographic. And so in return, perhaps for his tacit silence, we'll call it that, with regard to this first stage of the deal in the coming 6 weeks, he may receive in turn from Netanyahu certain policy changes or policy advances with regard to issues like West Bank settlement expansion.
Itamar Ben-Gvir boasted earlier this week how he, up until now, had managed to block any agreement, any ceasefire deal. I mean, how has that gone down in Israel?
Well, overall, it went down quite poorly because the hostage families and the majority of the Israeli public, according to every poll, who supported precisely this kind of deal to get as many hostages out of captivity in Gaza as possible, were angry at Ben-Gvir for being proud and taking credit for blocking past efforts at getting this deal over the line. And also people close to Benjamin Netanyahu and his supporters were also angry at Ben-Gvir for undermining the narrative that they put out there for the better part of the past year, which is that only Hamas was to blame for blocking any movement with regard to a ceasefire and hostage release deal, that Hamas was the obstacle, and that Israel under Netanyahu was actually willing to play ball and was actually very much willing willing to advance and pay the price to get this deal over the line. I happen to, in this instance, take Ben-Gvir at his word. I think he, along with Smotrich, their impact on the prime minister was decisive, and the fear of their resignations made Netanyahu backtrack last summer in particular to get a deal over the line.
Is there another factor here, too, when it comes to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? We've got the Trump administration beginning on Monday. Is there any suspicion that that incoming Trump administration may have offered him something, perhaps just reassurances, to get this deal over the line?
Well, we don't have any public confirmation of that. It's a sense that we have maybe behind closed doors. Certain guarantees and assurances were given to Netanyahu by the incoming U.S. president, as along with his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff. But I think the decisive factor here was Donald Trump making it clear after he won election last November that he wanted to see a deal in Gaza done by Inauguration Day. And I think he put the full weight of his personality and the full weight of the U.S. presidency on this issue, not only vis-a-vis Hamas and the Qatari and Egyptian mediators, but also on Israel and Netanyahu himself. And I think it was near impossible for Netanyahu not to deliver this deal to Trump before Inauguration Day. And according to the schedule, Trump will get that deal exactly one day before Inauguration Day.
Fair to say, though, that is it the hard work that begins from now?
It is. Look, this deal is a ceasefire, but it's a temporary ceasefire for the coming 6 weeks, what they call the first stage of this deal. Obviously, that's all for the good, both for the people of Gaza and the hostages that are going to come out and their loved ones here in Israel. And it's a necessary first step with regard to ending the war in Gaza, but it's not sufficient. According to the terms of the deal, negotiations will resume in about 2 weeks over the second stage. And the second stage of the deal will hopefully make the ceasefire permanent and also deliver from captivity the remaining Israeli hostages. But that's going to be a major, major lift for both parties. Yeah. If to get to this point was difficult enough, then those negotiations will be even more difficult. And we have to remain vigilant with regard to whether the ceasefire will continue.
Neri, thank you very much indeed. Neri Zilber of the Financial Times there. Well, the agreement is due to come into force from Sunday, as we've been saying, but there's been no let-up in Israel's bombardment of Gaza. Officials say more than 100 Palestinians have been killed since the deal was first announced. One young woman, Huda Matrabie, told the BBC about her hopes and fears for the future.
As a person living in Gaza, it's difficult to find the right words to describe really the complex feelings. So after so many years of conflict, after 15 months of destruction, ceasefire can feel like a fragile moment where we can breathe without the constant sound of bombs, without the sounds of gunfire. We displaced so many times, so many months. We don't have water, we don't have food. And my message is we want to live in peace. We want to live like other people in all the world. We deserve life.
Well, the deal stipulates 600 truckloads of humanitarian aid should be delivered every day under the agreement. But distributing that could prove difficult. Rosalia Bolland speaks for the UN children's charity UNICEF. She's in southern Gaza.
The scale of the humanitarian needs inside Gaza remain enormous, and this ceasefire agreement will be a critical first step. It must be upheld. But by itself, this ceasefire agreement will not automatically end the suffering of children in Gaza, because the needs are so high and because of the access constraints that we have been facing to bring aid into Gaza, with the collapse of all essential services and the scale of destruction in Gaza. Really, the needs are unimaginable. And besides humanitarian aid, we also need a scale up of commercial supplies. They have to come in large volumes into Gaza to help address the needs. I can give a couple of examples of the type of constraints that we face. So, very pragmatically speaking, one issue is related to the overcrowding. Here in southern Gaza, where I am, as soon as I get out of the UNICEF base, I can see makeshift tents as far as my eye sort of stretches. People really have put their tents almost on top of each other into the sand. This is a dune-like area. There's lots of rubble, there's lots of garbage. And just for us in our cars to navigate our way through those tents is quite a challenge. We drive very slowly. As you can imagine, four trucks, that's even more difficult. Now, we currently, there's lots of families here in the south, but they are very hopeful that once a ceasefire materializes, that they will be able to move back to their homes. Many families have their homes in the north. And so one thing that we anticipate is actually an important population movement,
right,
which we expect to be could also be quite chaotic.
Yeah,
from Rosalia, other parts.
Sorry to interrupt you, just because we're a bit limited for time. So there's going to be that chaos of people wanting to get back home. What about those who control some of the access? I mean, who is running the show in Gaza at the moment? Is it criminal gangs, as we've heard reported in the past?
Throughout Gaza, there is actually a complete breakdown in law and order. And as a result of that, criminal gangs have been able to take advantage of that over the past year, really. And indeed, the fact that not enough supplies have been coming in has created austerity and has created lots of pressure on the market, making looting even more profitable. You know, it's not just desperate families who are trying to get their hands on whatever they can, but it's also these criminal elements. If aid can come in, but not just aid, if commercial supplies can enter as well at scale simultaneously alongside these humanitarian supplies, by itself, that should to a certain extent address this issue of looting, in that it will make the looting less lucrative. It is lucrative right now because people are in need of everything. People don't have shampoo, sanitary pads, mattresses, blankets, clothes, food, you name it. So the moment that is restarted, we should gradually see a decline.
Rosalia Bolin of UNICEF in southern Gaza. Still to come on NewsHour, with emissions of carbon dioxide rising at record levels last year, are technologies to remove that CO2 from the atmosphere the solution?
Even though they're important in the calculation, it's expensive, it's difficult to do, and at the moment it's a tiny, tiny fraction of what needs to be done. There's far more to be gained, I think, from moving away from fossil fuels directly than by taking stuff out of the atmosphere. But every government is committed to doing it. It's a way of bringing industry with you, and I think that is a very important psychological and political message too.
More on that in 20 minutes. We'll also have more on the breaking news that the US Supreme Court has ruled against TikTok in its appeal over its imminent ban in the US. It must now sell its operations or close down by Sunday. More on that, as I say, in about 15 minutes. You're listening to NewsHour. This is the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Now, an extraordinary discovery has been made in the latest excavations at the ancient Roman city of Pompeii, which was buried under volcanic rock and ash where Mount Vesuvius erupted 2,000 years ago. Archaeologists have unearthed a beautifully preserved bathhouse inside a luxurious private residence. The spa-like complex is the first to be found in 100 years and is one of the largest ever discovered in the city. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, has been given exclusive access to the site, and she was shown around by Pompeii archaeologist Dr. Sophie Hay.
We're starting the tour in the hot room, the Calidarium. It's a sort of relatively large room, considering it's a private residence. So there's a basin in front of us. It would be filled with water. They would dip in and get clean. You've got what would have had marble floor, marble on the walls, a beautiful niche as well with potentially a little hole in to let light in. And you can kind of start imagining the people in this room and the noises, the sort of splashing of water, people discussing, you know, how they're getting clean or the politics of the day. It's very, very evocative of that era.
So you start with the hot room. So you get warm,
yes.
And then we're going to move through to quite a different space. This is the warm room.
Yes, and underneath our feet there's a whole other level because we've got hot air coming from the furnace room. So this is a suspended floor, and underneath us there's what is called a hypocaust system. So it's on little pillars, and so hot air would be underneath us. So it would feel a bit like a sauna, essentially. This is probably where you would, you know, put oil on your skin and have your slave sort of scrape it off with a stridgel.
And we're just going to keep on moving through because it's a sequence of rooms going through a very narrow doorway here.
So this would be the changing room, essentially. And around us we have these huge red panels of wall plaster, but in them you can see these little holes, and they would be the fixtures for a little shelf. So you can sit down and take your sandals off and then go in for the bath experience.
The floor's very beautiful as well, little mosaics and larger, is it marble?
It is, all different marbles from all around the Roman Empire, so you can really see the Roman Empire on the floor here.
And Sophie, we're going to cross this pretty threshold into another room, which is absolutely spectacular. Wow.
It is. It's a really magical space. This is basically the frigidarium of the bath complex.
So it's like a plunge pool almost.
Exactly that. Deep enough to plunge into, but there's also a little ledge so that the guests who were invited by the owner could come and sit and on a hot day dangle their legs in the cold water and cool off. Bathhouses in Pompeii in a private residence are really rare. We only know of a handful, and so for one to be on this scale must mean the owner is super rich. This is one of the very top of the elite. He had power, he had money, and wanted to show it off to clients and impress people.
Yeah, power, money, and a private bathhouse.
Indeed.
Dr. Sophie Hay there, ending that report by our science editor, Rebecca Morell. And there's a big piece if you want to take some look at some of the pictures of that bathhouse that Rebecca's done. It's all on our website, bbc.com/news. Pakistan now, because the country's former Prime Minister Imran Khan's been sentenced to 14 years in prison over a land corruption case. His wife was also jailed for 7 years. Khan's been in prison anyway since 2023 on other charges. The Pakistan expert Owen Bennett-Jones, who sometimes sits in this chair, is in Islamabad at the moment. I asked him what Imran Khan has been convicted of doing.
It's an extremely complex case, and I'll spare you the fine detail, but it involves a lot of money, £190 million, and it originated in London. There's lots of financial transactions that went on behind it, but basically the allegation is, and now you know he's been convicted, is that the money that should have gone into the state treasury went towards a project he had for an Islamic university. And one of the points that the defense was making is that there was no personal gain in this. Now, prosecutors challenged that, but the bulk of the money, anyway, was due to go to an Islamic university, which hasn't really happened, which hasn't helped Imran Khan's case. So, you know, that's the sort of area we're in. It is a highly, yeah, there's a lot of detail in it. But the conviction's there, and the sentences are now done.
He says, and his supporters say, that this is all about politics. It's about political revenge. Just remind us, I mean, who wants to keep him out of politics?
Well, the army and the current government. And, you know, it happens every time in Pakistan. Someone loses power, they immediately get hit with corruption cases, and then they grind through the courts. And then normally there's a political settlement and they get out of jail. So no one, you know, really experiences, except for one case way back, lengthy imprisonment, or in one case there was that death sentence of a Bhutto. But, you know, in general terms, the parties all expect this to happen. You know, any leader expects this to happen. They can either go abroad and dodge it, or they face it. And when they do face it, which Imran Khan has been doing, their popularity increases. It gets more difficult for the army and for the government to keep them in. And then there's talk of a deal. And there's already talk of a deal in this case.
On his popularity, I mean, how popular is he at the moment?
Impossible to measure, but very. And that is one of the problems that the military and the government have got here. Actually, his government ended in a fair amount of chaos, and it wasn't considered a great success. The moment that he was put in jail, there was a sharp increase in his popularity. You've got to remember, this is basically the most famous man in Pakistan for something like 50 years, from the moment he won the World Cup cricket way back. And he's just known by everybody in this country. Everyone's talking about him. If you watch the TV, his image is banned from the TV, has been for about a year. But that's all they talk about. It's just what's happening to Imran Khan. The government is a sideshow compared to this drama of what's happening to him, what's happening to his wife. Will the army cave? Will Imran Khan cave? Will a deal be done? Will he get out? If he does get out, will he keep to any commitments he makes not to attack the army? And so on. And that's all. Basically, all politics is reduced to that here now.
He does have, I mean, political power through his, I mean, the candidates that stood in last year's election, because they did very well, didn't they?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, there was, I mean, frankly, a campaign against his party. He wasn't allowed to use his party symbol. Everyone had to stand as independents. And despite the very confusing nature of the electoral system here, with all these ballot papers for a population that's got a significant number of illiterate people, he nonetheless did incredibly well. He got 93 seats. I spoke to someone who's sort of I would trust to give an accurate number of how many they should have got. 120, 130, the party says, yeah, many more than that. But the point is, they did incredibly well, despite a lot of hurdles put in their way. And that just reflects the fact that he is a popular man. And the longer he stays in jail, this is the problem everyone else here has got in the political system, the longer he stays in jail, the more popular he seems to get.
I mean, just briefly, all the tussle that you've talked about, I mean, what does that mean for real life in Pakistan? I mean, is it holding the country back, presumably?
Of course it is. And it's this constant political crisis here. Governments very rarely fill their full terms. And it just means that when people get into power, the only thing they're thinking about is hanging on to it. And they're not thinking about the health, the education, or the economy, or the rest of it that so many people really want them to focus on. And it's just all political drama. And we're right in the middle of one now.
And that's Owen Bennett-Jones speaking to me from Islamabad in Pakistan. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up, including more on that Supreme Court ruling in the US on the upcoming ban on TikTok. Do stay with us.
I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News Podcast, we're covering the latest in the Middle East, where Israel and Hamas have signed their ceasefire and hostage release agreement, which is due to take effect on Sunday. But until then, the war continues, with Palestinian authorities reporting at least 86 deaths from continued Israeli airstrikes on the territory since the announcement of the truce. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, as the population of Uganda's capital, Kampala, continues to grow, so does the pressure on public services such as waste management. The city's only major dump site, Katizi, is running out of space, and with the city producing an estimated 2,000 tonnes of waste every day, it's at risk of collapsing again, as it did last year, killing more than 30 people. Agnes Pender meets the volunteers at cleaning up Kampala and explores if there are any answers to the city's waste crisis.
Once a month, a group of around a dozen volunteers get together in Uganda's capital, Kampala, with one goal: to clean their city. 31-year-old Abel Odeke started the Equal Aqua Uganda group in 2020 because he felt a lot more could be done to manage Kampala's waste.
Actually, we have a very big problem in Kampala with waste management, because we really realize that there is no proper system where we separate the plastic from the food materials and from the metallic kind of stuff.
Kampala generates around 2,000 tons of waste every day. City authorities allow private companies to collect the waste, but there are no wide-scale recycling or incineration systems. Kampala's population is growing at a rapid rate of 4% per year, according to the latest national census. And the city's public services are under pressure. Kitezi is one of Uganda's largest dump sites, situated in Kampala. This 15-hectare wasteland is the final destination for the dump trucks operating across Kampala's 7 waste collection zones. Informal workers sift through garbage to find items that can be cleaned and resold. In August 2024, a large section of it collapsed, killing more than 30 people and burying several homes underneath. Okuku survived.
We saw the thing starting to move. I was very quick. I ran away. I ran from the side that was not falling. And maybe the unlucky people on that day, I think, didn't survive the tragedy.
The dump site has been expanding since it was established in 1996. Surrounded by settlements, the dump site has no more space to expand, except upwards. Throughout the day, dump trucks arrive and pile on the trash wherever they find space.
So that is not a right thing. You pile and pile and pile and pile. No, that is not right.
Urban planner Frank Muramuzi says this is a serious problem.
You cannot get the 4 million people and you go and get all those, all that waste, and you take them to one dumping site. No, that's not how we do it.
Urban planner Frank Muramuzi ending that report from Kampala in Uganda by Agnes Pender. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. As we've been hearing in the past half hour or so, the US Supreme Court has ruled against TikTok's appeal over its imminent ban in the United States. Let's talk to our senior North America reporter, Anthony Zerka. Anthony, what does that mean then? What happens now?
Well, it means no stay of execution for TikTok. The Supreme Court decided not to step in and either put on hold the implementation of this sale or ban law or to strike it down on free speech grounds. Now, the court issued a fairly narrow decision. They acknowledged that they were under time pressure here because the ban goes into effect on Sunday night. But the bottom line is that legal remedies for TikTok to avoid this ban have now been exhausted. If there's going to be something that saves TikTok, it's going to have to be a business or a political deal that either transfers the ownership to an American company or some other sort of a negotiation between politicians and the people who own TikTok.
Anthony, I'm just reading this, which I'm sure you've seen, this White House statement that came out in the past few minutes, which says, at the end, the administration recognizes that actions to implement the law simply must fall to the next administration, which, of course, takes office on Monday. What might that mean? Could that mean that President Biden, just before he leaves office, says, look, we're going to delay implementation of this and then we'll let Donald Trump decide?
Yeah, it's pretty convenient for the Democrats. They can kind of wash their hands on this and punt it to the incoming Republican administration. This is going to be Trump's problem to sort out. Now, the ban does technically go into effect on midnight on Sunday, but it is a holiday on Monday, a national holiday on Monday. And I think what you're seeing from the Democrats and the Biden administration is, hey, this is really complicated. We can't figure it out in time. It's your concern now if you want to find a way to keep this popular social media app that has 180 million users in America online and avoid the outroar that is going to come from some people who are very keen on the site. You're going to have to find that way out on your own.
And President Trump has indicated what? That he actually is not in favor of this ban. Is that right?
It was a little more complicated than that. He actually, his lawyers weighed in and asked the Supreme Court to delay a decision on this, something the Supreme Court declined to do, because according to his legal brief, that Donald Trump is a master negotiator and he would find a way out of this, a way of satisfying the national security concerns while also allowing TikTok to continue to operate in the U.S. So he had expressed in the past support for the ban, but clearly he is feeling pressure from some of his supporters who love TikTok, particularly people tied to the tech world. And he is trying to find a way to have his cake and eat it too, essentially.
Is there any chance it seems unlikely in sort of 48 hours, but is there any chance it could be sold? Someone might buy it?
There's always a possibility. According to readouts, Donald Trump had a conversation with President Xi of China, and they talked about TikTok. So there could be some sort of a last-minute deal. And you have to remember this ban, while it's called a ban, but its impact won't immediately be felt no matter what. TikTok app is not going to disappear from your phone. The service, unless TikTok decides to shut it down, isn't going to stop in the U.S. immediately. What may be more difficult is to download the app from app stores like iTunes and the Google App Store, because they'll be taken down from those sites and you can't get an update to the app once new updates come out. So eventually it'll cease to function, but it won't be the flick of a light switch at midnight on Sunday unless TikTok decides that's what they want to do.
Anthony, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Anthony Zerker joining us from Washington. Also in Washington, D.C., Aidan Coe Murphy, who's a TikToker based in the city, and he set up and runs Gen Z for Change, a non-profit which uses the platform to encourage young people to get involved in civil discourse. Aidan, welcome to the programme. Your reaction to the Supreme Court upholding this ban?
Yeah, not super surprised. The hearings earlier this week did not kind of indicate that they were going to be super supportive to keeping the app on constitutional grounds. But I think we're all waiting to see what President Biden and President Trump are going to do, because you have President Biden now saying that he won't enforce the ban, but also no one really understands what that means exactly for the platform and for the app store. So it's a very weird situation on TikTok right now. People are very sentimental, definitely preparing for the end.
Yeah, and what does preparing mean? I mean, have you been thinking about what you might do if it is banned from Sunday and it disappears from devices?
Yeah, I think a lot of content creators have spent, because TikTok has been under threat so many different times, people have spent like a decent amount of time building out platforms on other other apps. I will say TikTok is kind of uniquely suited to be used to get like information out there to reach people with news and get young people engaged and empowered in progressive organizing. So I think that there are a lot of things that if TikTok is banned in the end, young people would lose out on. But I think that it's certainly not going to be the end of the trend we've seen in content creation.
Yeah, my teenage daughters get all their information from TikTok. Yeah. I mean, do you have any sympathy for the government's argument that it's a threat to national security because it's owned by a Chinese company and they believe that it's a way for Beijing to spy on users? I mean, do you have any sympathy for that argument?
Yeah, I think if there's evidence there, I know that that's still kind of an ongoing question. But what I do know is that like I and a large proportion of young people support comprehensive data privacy legislation. We're not oblivious to the fact that there is a data privacy crisis in America. and action needs to be taken to protect young people and just social media users' data. But that's true for Meta, for X. And as we're seeing all these billionaires become chummier and chummier in America, that is even more clear.
But for you and your foundation, what the benefits of TikTok and the access it gives you to young people outweigh those doubts, do they?
Yeah, and I think that honestly, what we've kind of seen with the White House is that that's and the Democratic Party is that that's true for them as well, because they have used TikTok frequently, whether it's engaging with influencers or using the platform to build out campaign accounts. Like, they recognize the power that TikTok has to mobilize young people. So, yeah.
Aidan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Aidan Coe Murphy uses TikTok, based in Washington, D.C. He runs Gen Z for Change. We'll have to see what happens in the coming days on that. Now, levels of the planet warming gas carbon dioxide rose more quickly last year than ever previously recorded. That's according to data from a research station in Hawaii. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere now stands at more than 50% higher than it was in pre-industrial times. Matt McGrath is the BBC's environment correspondent. Apart from the usual man-made reasons, why were emissions so high last year?
It was an El Nino year, so this means that the plants and trees don't absorb as much carbon dioxide, which means more of it goes into the atmosphere. We also had an awful lot of forest fires, and that also throws huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So you take those factors together, it explains the record surge well above what scientists were expecting.
There's been some suggestion that it might happen this year. The world is about to reach peak CO2 emissions. Is that right?
Most of it depends on what China does. And since China doesn't report its actual emissions for 3 or 4 years after they've happened, no one will really know for another few years. But there's a strong expectation. I think about half of experts that look at this believe that we may already have peaked or we may be about to peak this year. And that is explained by a number of factors. Obviously, the surge in solar power across the world, particularly in China, but also in transport. The number of electric vehicles sold in China last year, 11 million, really making it likely that we may have a peak in at least road transport emissions this year.
Which sounds like good news, but we've had the British Met Office saying that that internationally agreed target of 1.5 Celsius will be missed. I mean, is that target completely out of the window now?
In scientific terms, we are getting closer and closer to that not being a realistic thing to hold on to. And the reality is that in the next 7 or 8 years, we'll probably go past it, probably, if not for good, for a long, long time. But politically, because of its importance in terms of unifying nations of the world together to fight climate change, it's something that I don't think any politician can really say it's done.
Is there any way to get that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? We hear about carbon capture and storage. Is that a realistic solution?
It's a solution that's been increasingly seen by governments as realistic, essentially to keep temperatures around 1.5 by the middle of the century to get to net zero by that point. Almost all the calculations that are done require some element of carbon capture and some element of carbon removal from the atmosphere. Now, you can capture carbon from coal-fired power plants or oil plants or gas plants by strapping on expensive apparatus, essentially, that captures that carbon and you can bury it under the ground. There are other ways of doing this as well. Directly capturing it from the air is also on the rise. Many, many companies have been set up to do this. All of them, though, it's expensive, it's difficult to do, and at the moment, it's a tiny, tiny fraction of what needs to be done. There's far more to be gained, I think, from moving away from fossil fuels directly, but every government is committed to doing it. It's a way of bringing industry with you, and I think that is a very important psychological and political message, too.
We've got a new president in the White House, Donald Trump, on Monday. What is the expectation from scientists about the impact of the Trump administration on all that we've been talking about?
I think there's a sense of, you know, we have been here before and he will probably leave the Paris Climate Agreement. And some calculations say that if he's successful in overturning many parts of the regulations that President Biden put in place, then the United States could add 4 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by 2030. That's the annual emissions of the entirety of Europe and Japan put together. But I think there's also been a bit of a softening in the rhetoric. There's less talk about climate hoax, more talk about climate scams. So I think there'll be moves away from the funding, move away from electric vehicles. He seems to have a particular hatred of wind turbines. So I think there will be certainly big moves like that. But as we saw 4 years ago, states have a lot of power here. Cities have a lot of power in the United States. While they can't turn the entire US emissions strategy around by themselves, they can make a serious indent on it. And one commentator observed, while regulations will change and the rhetoric will definitely change, the ultimate outcome may not be entirely different in the amount of energy, because right now the United States is the world's biggest producer of oil and gas.
That was our environment correspondent, Matt McGraw, there. There is a live page up and running on that news while we've been on air this hour, that the Supreme Court in the US has knocked back TikTok's appeal on its upcoming ban. That's due to take effect at midnight on Sunday. Do take a look at all the latest updates, including some more detail on what the Supreme Court said. It was a unanimous decision. Let me just read you this. TikTok's scale and susceptibility, the court said, to foreign adversary control, together with the vast swathes of sensitive data the platform collects, justify differential treatment to address the government's national security concerns. As I say, bbc.com/news, that live page on that US Supreme Court ruling on TikTok up and running. Do stay with us here on NewsHour. Still more to come, including the actor Nicolas Cage. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Theme tune of the 1990s TV series Twin Peaks, perfectly conveying the mystery and strangeness of what was a groundbreaking drama at the time. It was co-created by the director David Lynch, who's died at the age of 78. Part of a unique body of work that includes movies such as Mulholland Drive, Blue Velvet and The Elephant Man, which all share Lynch's unique and unsettling vision. Well, back in 2014, he spoke to the BBC's entertainment correspondent Colin Paterson about taking inspiration from all things industrial. They were talking after the launch of a David Lynch art exhibition in the English city of Middlesbrough.
I love derelict factories. I like smoke. I like fire. I like oil. I like soot.
You've got to get yourself to Middlesbrough.
I went to Northern England once in search of the great factories that I'd heard about. And when I arrived there, this was many years ago, they were tearing one smokestack down a week. All the factories were disappearing. It was like being stabbed in the heart.
In that interview, he also criticized what he saw as the demise of independent filmmaking.
The film business, as you know, has changed. The art houses are gone. It's a sad time for alternative cinema. But the new art house is cable television. Different kind of ideas, non-summer blockbuster type films are ending up on cable television.
Well, one of his best-known movies is 1990's Wild at Heart, starring Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, which won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival.
Look like a clown in that stupid jacket.
Plus, it's a snakeskin jacket. And for me, it's a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom.
Nicolas Cage there, a sailor in Wild at Heart. Well, last night, my colleague Tim Franks spoke to the man himself.
Well, look, it is a very sad day. I got the news and I was, I know he was contending with a lot. My grandfather had the same situation, so I know it wasn't easy for him. But he was so joyful. He was a lot of fun. I mean, that seems like a trite word, but he made it important to enjoy yourself on the movie set. And, you know, before I worked with David, I was a very serious kind of method acting, 19 on like Birdie, and I thought I had to torture myself. But David said, it's not only important for you to have fun, it's necessary. The audience needs this. And he was a true American surrealist. He wasn't like it. He's one of a kind. So he's really going to be missed in cinema, I think. I remember how inspired he was by Fellini. He loved all things, Italian style, furniture, music, and cinema, and he would invoke Fellini quite a bit, but he always had music playing on the set, and he was so free. He was so loose and relaxed and spontaneous and coming up with ideas on the go. You never knew what you were going to do on a David Lynch movie on that set. It was always full of surprises. And he once told me to sing an opera song about cotton balls. I mean, it just came out of nowhere and he put it in the movie, but it was that free. You know, he really was a joyous man with just a hell of a sense of humor and so fun and funny to work for. And he used to always say, solid gold, Nick. That was solid gold, buddy. And
but what's interesting to hear in what you're saying is that he was a man. I mean, he clearly had a very sort of particular vision, a particular tone that he brought to his work. And you might imagine that he would be, you know, he could be this sort of driven monomaniac. But actually, you're suggesting that he came across as a sort of as an easygoing guy.
He was. I mean, he I think he knew how to control his emotions. Like if he was angry, he knew how to get put in check. You know, like I remember once, you know, sometimes you can get a song stuck in your head and you can't get it out. And I kept hearing that song, Spinning Wheel. I don't know who did that. Mama's a, I don't know. It's a horrible song. And I said to David, I'm going to sing it. And he would, don't do it, Nixter. Buddy, don't do it. Promise me you're not going to sing that song. And he was serious. And like, I almost wanted to do it just to prank him. And I could tell he was going to get really angry about it because
it could get very dark.
He didn't want it to mess up, stay in his head and mess up his groove. But here's the thing about Lynch. He wasn't just weird for weird's sake in cinema. I mean, it was a true thing with him. It was honest. It was pure. It was a genuine expression. And I don't know. I still don't know really how he did it, but he didn't force it. It just came out of him naturally. And it's like I read your thing in The Guardian in England. It's like, yeah, you know, he made it mainstream. He made surrealism mainstream. I totally concur with that. I used to go see Eraserhead. Hello?
Oh, sorry, Nick. I was just going to say, we haven't got much time left. I was just going to ask whether you think that he is unique or whether Hollywood could cope with another David Lynch.
Well, I think David is one of a kind, and he is unique. I don't think you can replace him, so that's my answer there. But he's largely instrumental for why I got into filmmaking. I used to see his show, his movie Eraserhead at the New Art in Santa Monica. I grew up watching that when I was in high school. So anyway, yeah, to answer your question, he's one of a kind, and he can't be replaced.
The actor Nicolas Cage paying his tribute to the director David Lynch, who's died. Now, every schoolchild learns it was probably a huge meteorite that wiped out the dinosaurs after it struck Earth. It was a cataclysmic event. Well, now, for the first time, the sight and sound of a meteorite hitting the Earth has been caught on camera. So brace yourself. Not quite so cataclysmic, is it? But it is, I promise, a meteorite, admittedly a small one. And that's the sound of it hitting the driveway of Joe and Laura Kelly's house in Prince Edward Island, Canada. It was recorded by the couple's doorbell camera. If you didn't catch it first time, here it is again, slowed down for dramatic effect. Well, the rocks confirmed to be chondrite, a relic from the birth of the solar system 4 billion years ago. And if you're thinking, well, big deal, then spare a thought for Joe Kelly, the homeowner. He'd been standing at the point of impact a few moments earlier and was left in no doubt it might have killed him. I should say these things enter the atmosphere at anything between 25 and 160,000 miles per hour. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next time, take care. Bye-bye.
I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News Podcast, we're covering the latest in the Middle East, where Israel and Hamas have signed their ceasefire and hostage release agreement, which is due to take effect on Sunday. But until then, the war continues, with Palestinian authorities reporting at least 86 deaths from continued Israeli airstrikes on the territory since the announcement of the truce. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.